I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. The protests that began in Tunisia almost a year ago have reverberated across the Arab world. Demonstrators in Syria took to the streets in the early spring demanding reforms, and the government quickly responded with a violent crackdown. Amnesty International estimates that more than 1,800 Syrians have died or been killed this year, many shot by security forces. An August report by Amnesty titled Deadly Detention concludes that thousands have been arrested. As many as 88 have died in detention with evidence of torture in 52 cases. The brother of one of those victims joins us on Radio Times. But first, we begin with Deborah Amos, who covers the Middle East for NPR News, and she joins us from Beirut. And Deborah Amos, what a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Very glad to be here.
How would you describe the protest movement today?
It is certainly different than it was even a few months ago. Just in June, there were cities that were outside the Syrian government control. Hama was one of those cities in the middle of the country, and also Deir ez-Zor near the Iraqi border. There was a huge crackdown in both of those cities, and Western diplomats will tell you that the leadership in both of those towns was decapitated. However, protests have continued in both places, mostly because this is an idea. It's not about a leadership. And so even this week, we saw a school opened. There were high school and middle school kids on the street taking a risk of being shot by security people to go out on the street and protest. So despite the crackdown, and it has been extensive, the protest movement continues. Even in the suburbs around the capital and even in the economic capital of Syria, which is Aleppo, the second largest city in the north.
You say this is about an idea. What is that idea?
Well, you know, in the beginning, Marty, what you heard from the demonstrators is reform, but it quickly moved to overthrowing the regime. And what it means for many of these activists is a new system of governance in Syria. You know, they talk about democracy. These people are inexperienced politically. This is a country that's been ruled for 40 years by one party and one family. But they are learning quickly in long discussions on Skype each night, trying to knit together an opposition meeting, opposition organization. And that is what they say they want. To replace the Assad regime.
It has been described in doing some reading for preparation for this show as a kind of leaderless movement. But clearly there are groups involved in this movement and individuals. How would you describe, I guess, its organizational structure, if there is one, Deborah?
Well, it is true. It is a bit chaotic when you look at the opposition. Of course, there are the street organizers, young people who are the energy of this movement. They have organized themselves into a couple different kinds of organizations. There's the local coordinating committees. They work as journalists, citizen journalists, reporting what's happening on the street. They also are a form of organization. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've had an opposition meeting in Istanbul where you saw outside opposition exiles who, for one reason or another, ran afoul of the regime and have been anti-government for many years, come together in Istanbul. At the same time, there was another meeting inside Damascus where longtime opposition members actually were allowed to meet. And they are coming together slowly, certainly not as quickly as the opposition came together in Libya, but they are moving towards some sort of organizational structure.
The government has cracked down on these largely nonviolent protests. What has the government done in terms of targeting Syrians and targeting these protesters?
There has been an uptick in targeting, especially those who organize nonviolent protests. The regime has raised the price on peaceful protesters and in some ways tried to push the movement towards taking up arms, towards fighting back against the army. And in some places that is happening. Western diplomats will tell you inside Syria it is not an insurgency yet. But there are people who are shooting back. Two kinds. Army defectors in some places have appointed themselves protectors of these nonviolent protesters. There's also citizens who are so angry about the kind of violence that has been visited in their communities that they, too, have taken up weapons. There is talk among some of the opposition that, you know, it is time to take up arms against the Syrian army. There is a much larger faction in the opposition that say that is not a winning strategy, that nonviolence is the way to go, that organizing the opposition is the way to go to keep up the pressure on the regime.
And how has the regime been able to maintain power? And is it through this violent crackdown on protesters?
It's partly about violence. It's partly about the structure of Syria. This is one of the most complicated, complex societies in the Middle East. It is a regime that is essentially run by a minority. The Alawite sect is somewhere around 12 to 20% of the population. And those people are heavily represented in the upper reaches of the military, in business, in the regime. Bashar al-Assad, the president's family, is from the Alawite sect. And so that community has stayed behind the president and the crackdown. Other minorities, out of fear, have stayed loyal to the regime. There is a large Christian minority in Syria, and they have been convinced, because the regime puts it on television every night, that the protesters are mostly Islamists, gangs who will take away the secularism of Syria if they win. And there are plenty of people who want to believe that. And so the army has stayed loyal to the regime. That did not happen in Egypt. It did not happen in Tunisia. It did not happen in Libya. So the dynamic in Syria is different.
And I notice that the Syrian ambassador to the United States has been a guest on a number of shows recently, and he blames thugs, you know, terrorists, as you say, Islamists, for what's going on inside his country.
You know, I had a conversation with a Saudi journalist a couple of days ago, and he said he was sitting in the office of a Saudi official who was talking directly to Bashar al-Assad, and Bashar al-Assad said to him, "These are terrorist gangs." And he said, the Saudi official was laughing, was looking at me and laughing. He said, "Look, we get reports," and he was talking about the Saudi hierarchy, "we get reports from Saudi intelligence. More important, we get reports from Jordanian intelligence, who know very well what's happening inside the country." This is a line that the regime has put out. Hardly anybody outside the country believes it.
Syria is becoming more isolated because of what's going on inside the country. Does it have allies in the region, though, Deborah?
It certainly does. The Iranians are a very close ally and have been for 30 years with the Syrians. Hezbollah here in Lebanon, where I am, which is a Shiite militia and political movement, are aligned with the Syrian government. And they have actually shifted a bit in the last couple of weeks, talking more about that the president of Syria really should be talking to the protesters. What it looks like is hedging their bets a bit, saying to Bashar, "Can you really survive with this kind of strategy? Can you survive killing somewhere around 100 people a week?" On the other side, we have seen the Turks, that were a very close ally of Bashar al-Assad, moving away. And today, for the first time, the prime minister of Turkey said he was considering imposing sanctions against Syria. He's not said that before. He was in a meeting with President Obama at the United Nations in New York. And out of that meeting, he said that he no longer was in contact with the Syrian leadership. He said he was sad to say that was true, but events pushed him in this direction. And it may very well be that Erdogan was pushed in this direction by an event that happened last week, and that is a Syrian army defector who fled to Turkey was somehow kidnapped out of a Turkish camp, brought back to Damascus, put on television, and forced to recant that he had left the army. It has been an embarrassment to Turkey that they couldn't protect a refugee inside the country. There are suspicions that it was a sting operation inside Turkey by Syrian intelligence And that may be the reason that Prime Minister Erdogan, Turkey's prime minister, has moved towards saying that he is considering sanctions. It's a big step for the Turks.
You're joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. Are you able to get inside Syria at all?
On this trip, no. There have been no visas for any of the journalist community that is here. Back in June and early July, the Syrians did let a small contingent of journalists in. I was one of them. It was very interesting to be there. It was a moment that they wanted some international publicity for something they were calling the National Dialogue. It is Bashar al-Assad's way of saying that he will reform. He will have the population come and talk. But they asked us to leave before those visas ran out. And they have been hot and cold on international coverage. Their media has been shown a relentless propaganda campaign trying to convince their own citizens that this is a conspiracy, a foreign conspiracy. There was a documentary a few nights ago on one of the Syrian channels that said that Americans and French and Israelis had built model cities, Syrian cities, in the deserts of Qatar. And there, we were producing fake videos of the demonstration. So there's been a huge propaganda campaign inside Syria to convince Syrians that this is all a plot.
Do you think there's some parallels between, and we have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, but some parallels to the uprisings in some of the neighboring countries? And I'm thinking about the use of social media and Facebook. I know that something like 60% of the population in Syria is younger than 30. Are there parallels, Deborah?
Well, somewhat, but let's also remember that only less than 17% are online. It is more a YouTube revolution where young protesters document their own demonstrations and put those videos online. And their Arab channels, one run by the Saudis, Al Arabiya, and one based in Qatar, Al Jazeera Arabic, are running them relentlessly. And so the entire Arab world is seeing this Syrian revolution through the videos that are shot on cell phones by these young activists. And it is a relentless campaign to see it on television. And I think that Syria is different than other places for that reason. It is the Arab satellite channels that are playing a huge role.
Well, as always, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Deborah Amos, thank you so much.
I thank you.
And that's Deborah Amos, and she covers the Middle East for NPR News, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we get an update on what's been going on in Syria. We have a guest here in our studio and one waiting in the wings on the telephone, and we will continue our conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Next time on APM SymphonyCast, we're at the BBC Proms, where music enthusiasts queued up early to get a prime spot to hear one of the best ensembles in the world, the Philadelphia Orchestra. Hi, I'm Allison Young. It's one of our own playing in London with music that was written just for them. That's coming up on APM SymphonyCast.
Sunday night at 8 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, inviting you to join us later today for a very special web chat at whyy.org/garden@high noon. We'll discuss everything you need to know about fall planting, garlic, pansies, lawn care, composting, and more. That's today at noon at whyy.org/garden.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Arab Spring revolutions that toppled regimes controlling Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya have also rocked Syria. The rule of Bashar al-Assad has been challenged on the street, and the regime has cracked down violently with military force, mass incarcerations, and brutal torture, earning the condemnation of the U.S. and other nations. We continue our conversation now with Morhaf Jouajati. He's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, also a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. That's a mouthful. And Morhaf Jouajati, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Dr. Hazem Halak. He's a scientist and researcher here in the Philadelphia area. And this past spring, he learned that his brother, Dr. Sakhar Halak, had been murdered by government forces. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Hazem Halak, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And I'm so sorry about your brother.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I do want to begin with you, if I could, and begin with your brother. His body was found in a ditch by the side of the road on May 25th. Earlier this year. Clearly there were signs that he had been tortured. I know you have seen a photograph of his body. What did it look like?
Well, let me tell you the story behind the photograph.
Sure.
So when we learned about his death, we didn't really have any photographs because the government guarded the body until they buried them, you know, they buried the body themselves. So really we didn't have pictures or and then also they wrapped the body with gauze like a mummy, so nobody could take any pictures. But in the last couple of weeks, I've been contacted by some of the government agents who actually took bodies of took pictures of my brother's bodies, the tortured body, and offered to sell them to me. And so it's not insulting enough to torture and mutilate the body, but actually I get a contact from somebody asking me if I'm interested in buying their pictures. So that I did do it. And the reason I did it for two reasons. One of them is for the legal issues. You know, it's, you know, as you know.
Evidence.
Exactly, as an evidence. And the other thing, I really was hoping to look at his face and see a peaceful, dead face. And unfortunately, I'm not going to lie to you. If you look at his face, it looks so much in pain. You can see the pain and the terror, itch on his face. I cannot get that out of my head. But, you know, it took me a week to look at to bring myself to look at the body. But finally I did, and I have to tell you, it's not a pity sight.
Well, and not to belabor this, but I also read that the autopsy doctor actually cried when he saw your brother's body.
Yes, yes, yes. Actually, what happened is when they brought the body to the morgue, all the doctors were there, and they all were hyped to see what's going on, why somebody killed their colleague. And believe it or not, the government was so proud to show these doctors the body because they want to scare them. So everybody was allowed to go ahead and see the body. And yeah, so one of my brother's friend, he did his own autopsy because the government autopsy was already pre-written, pre-signed. And yes, he said he actually, first time in his life, he cried when he see his colleague like that.
And what that body looked like.
Yeah.
Why do you think your brother was detained and then killed?
Well, you know, it's very hard for you to believe living in the United States, and it was very hard for me to believe that living here for, you know, 20 plus years. But he came to the United States to attend a meeting. And when he went back from the meeting back Syria, you know, he's a very well-known physician, and he's very he does eating disorder, so he has a clinic, and so he's very well-known in Aleppo. And apparently what happened, him and other physicians, so it's not only him, right, signed a petition that for the government of Syria to allow these people, the physicians, to give first aid to anybody who was injured in a protest, just first aid. And then the government could take them after that. And the government didn't like that. So what they want to do, they want to punish the whole doctors. And believe it or not, that was actually a conscious decision. They met and they decided who we're going to use to teach these physicians a lesson. And they said, okay, this doctor is well-known. He just came back from the United States and will be perfect. So they picked him, they tortured him, they killed him, mm-hmm. they mutilated him, and they dumped his body.
And who's the they?
The government forces, security forces. And interesting, you know, because the way they took him, they kidnapped him from the street. And the reason they do that, if they want to kill somebody, they kidnap. If they want to return somebody, they take them from their home. So it was, you know, conscious decision on their part. They really want to take this person, they want to kill him, but they want him to be found, and they want to use him as a lesson.
And to send a message to other doctors?
Exactly.
And a message to your family, do you think, as well?
Message to my family, message to other doctors, message to the whole Aleppo. What do you think Aleppo people are scared?
And this is the city where he lived.
Yes, yes. I talked to doctors from Aleppo, and they told me, I swear they told me, if you see the body of your brother, you will never do anything wrong. And I didn't believe them until I saw that the pictures mm-hmm. I have. And if you see these pictures, I have a before and after pictures, it's amazing. I mean, the amount of torture. I actually cannot believe any human being is able or capable of doing this to some other human being.
Murav Jouajadi, let me get you in on the conversation. And what Hazem Halak is talking about has been documented by Amnesty International. How common do you think is the detention in this case and the torture of Syrians?
It has become pretty common. There is no particular group that is targeted. Anybody that is seen or perceived as aiding, whether directly or indirectly, this uprising would suffer the same consequences. There are many doctors, unfortunately, who have been tortured and killed because they have treated patients in private hospitals. There are others. There is a cartoonist recently who was abducted, beaten up, and because he's a cartoonist, his fingers were broken and dumped also alongside a road. This is to deter. This is to bring home the lesson to anybody who wants to oppose the Assad regime that his or her fate are going to be uncertain. There is the case of a pianist, a famous Syrian pianist, who is here in the United States, who is in the opposition movement. The Syrian security forces could not get to him because he is here in the United States. So they beat up his elderly parents, again to deter Syrians not only on the inside, but even those who are expatriate, that their fate is going to be painful.
And have these incidents increased since the start of the demonstrations, Muhaf?
Yes, I think they have increased. The level of violence generally has increased. The regime has been less and less hesitant to use massive force. In parallel to this, the number of detentions has increased very dramatically. Torture. In the most bestial of fashions. And here the regime really has no qualms about taking photographs and distributing them, again with the purpose of deterring would-be protesters.
Hazem, let me go back to you. Your brother came to the United States for a conference. He was a specialist in eating disorders. This was a yes. conference on eating disorders?
Yes, in Miami. And, you know, Mari, I've been in this country for more than 20 years. He never visited me. So the only reason he came here is to attend the conference. And he attends this conference every year. This year was in Miami, so it was a good excuse for me to see him. And so that was the only reason he attended the conference. He never met with anybody.
Was your brother in any way critical of the government? Was he political living in
No, actually, Syria? You know, I would like to make it clear. None of our family is. And if it wasn't for my brother and now for all the other death, I wouldn't even be involved. I'm not associated with any party. I'm not with the opposition. I'm not a political person. As you know, I'm a scientist, and that's what I do for a living. And but the death of my brother brought me to this. But no, he wasn't, and he was actually somebody who capitalized on Bashar al-Assad presidency because he was from the elite and the rich and, you know, people who live in Aleppo, who is not demonstrating now.
And are you worried about family left in Syria?
Well, you know, I mean, that's what they're trying to do, Marley. They're trying to scare us. Do you think when they released that 13-year-old Hamza al-Khatib body mutilated? You think
the little boy.
Yeah. Why do you think they did that? They're capable of burning the body, disappear it. They do that to send a message. And what they're trying to scare me. Why they beat the parents of the pianist? they want to scare us. I'm not going to be scared. You know, if they want to kill me, then fine. I mean, there's nothing I could do. I have to, you know, in Syria, one person die every hour. Four people get detained every hour, except on Fridays, actually, is more. So if I don't speak, who else is going to speak? I'm doing this for the Syrian people. I started for my brother, but now I'm doing it for the rest of the Syrian people.
And that's Hazem Halak. He's a scientist, researcher based here in Philadelphia. His brother, Dr. Sakhar Halak, murdered by government forces earlier this year. Joining us by telephone is Morhaf Jouajati, a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs. Both of them joining us today in Radio Times to help us understand what is going on inside of Syria and what the protest movement is about, and, of course, the challenges facing the international community as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. Morhaf Jouajati, do you think the regime of al-Assad is in any way vulnerable because there is more condemnation by the international community? Do you think that's having any effect on the government itself?
Certainly. The Assad regime now is almost totally isolated internationally. The Security Council has discussed the case of Syria. There are sanctions that have been imposed on the Assad regime by the United States and by the EU. Turkey today declared its potential intention of imposing sanctions on Syria. So at the international level and also at the regional level, the Assad regime has been condemned and is becoming increasingly isolated. At the domestic level, the more violence that the Assad regime is using against an unarmed civilian uprising is only alienating people further, angering them further, and enticing them to go down on the street in order to demand that the regime go away. So there, at no point in recent history has the Assad regime been as isolated as it is now.
Deborah Amos was describing the protester, the uprising, the movement such as it is, and describing it, as others have, as perhaps leaderless. Does that concern you, Morhaf?
Look, it concerned me in the beginning in that you really cannot have a revolution if it is leaderless. If you cannot identify a leader, if you do not identify a policy or a strategy or what have you, it is quite understandable that these local coordination committees would choose not to have a leadership because the leadership would be decapitated fairly easily in Syria. But as things progressed, as the crisis progressed, now the opposition is putting together a united front and a united leadership in order, again, to do away with the earlier fragmentation so as to take away any potential obstacles to the collapse of the Assad regime. So now the opposition, again, is far more united and is beginning to have a leadership, something it did not have early on.
Do you think there's a role for the United States, or should the United States sort of stay in the background?
There's a major role for the United States. The United States, of course, is a superpower, and it is a permanent member of the Security Council, and it can bring a lot of pressure to bear on those states that are represented in the Security Council in order and in view of condemning the Assad regime and of potentially indicting the Assad regime to an international criminal court for crimes against humanity. And this has been the case when the United States imposed sanctions or further sanctions on the Assad regime. Other states followed, namely those of the EU. And so now it is a matter of the United States and EU allies to persuade the Russians and the Chinese, who have veto power in the Security Council, to no longer be an obstacle in the way of a Security Council condemnation of the Assad regime.
And we're going to try to get you on a better phone line. So we're going to call you back, and I want to just continue with our guest here in our studio, Hazem Halak. You actually called in to talk of the nation. I heard that call, and this was when the Syrian ambassador to the U.S. Was a guest on the show. You talking about your brother, said that he was killed and kidnapped by the government, as you have said on today's show. You said by the Mukhabarat, which is, I guess, the secret police. And here's what the ambassador said back to you. There's no proof whatsoever that the government has harassed him. That would be your brother, not to say kidnapped or killed him. This is an absolutely false accusation, and you can add to it the plethora of false accusations. The fact that he was murdered in Aleppo was nothing to do whatsoever with the insurgency in Syria. And I know this is something the government has said about others who have been detained and tortured. Your response to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Syria maintains two fronts. Okay. One of them, as I mentioned, terrorized the people inside. So my brother was used to terrorize a doctor. Two doctors contacted me. They were detained after my brother's death, and they were told if they don't stop aiding the protesters, they're going to follow his path. Okay? That's what the government used to.
So real threat to them.
Exactly. So they're using him to threat to the other doctors. That's what the front inside the United States. The outside United States is Mr. Absolutely Not. Anything absolutely false. You know, you say to them, are you a loving journalist? Yes, we are. And they're not. You know, they deny. So they maintain two fronts. The inside one, they proud of their torture. They use that to scare the people. The outside one, oh, no, we didn't do anything. Everything is a lie. I mean, they sold me the pictures of my dead brother. Mm-hmm. What other proof do you want? You know, people contacted them in here, there, you know, so there's no other thing I could give them.
I also read that they initially accused the Mossad of killing your brother.
Exactly. My father, the first day he died, yes, he got a call from the prime minister of Syria who said, you know, your son is very, very prominent, very well known, and we think maybe the Mossad did that too, you know, and watch the other brother. And I took this as a more of a threat than anything else, really, because I don't think anybody else will go and kill a scientist in eating disorder.
The other person they accused was your brother's office manager.
Yeah, they basically tried to accuse everybody. But you know, Marty, they never did any. You know where they found the body? They never sent a car to look in the body. The people who found the body brought him to the morgue. They never went there and looked. They never did anything. Never did any actually real detective work. So that tells you.
And we should say, and I'm sorry to say this, sure. but he was found in a ditch by the side of the road.
Yes. And, you know, he was dumped 20 kilometers away from his hometown. And, you know, they were hoping some more mutilation probably by end. But he was found 6 hours after his death.
And how long was he actually detained?
He started on Wednesday night, and Thursday morning he opened his Facebook up. That's common in Syria when you get detained. The first thing they do, they let you go onto your Facebook to see who your friends, what kind of chatting you have. So that's another proof we have. And then my inside information, which I got from using my own investigation, they started torturing him Thursday night. And by Friday noon, he was dead.
Oh, goodness. Hazem Halak, our guest today in Radio Times. He's a scientist researcher based here in Philadelphia. And hopefully we have a better phone line to our other guest, Morhaf Jouajati. And we are talking about Syria today on Radio Times, opening up the lines for any questions or comments that you might have. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
On the next Fresh Air, some advice on how to figure out what medical option is best for you when faced with difficult decisions about medications and interventions. We talk with doctors Jerome Groopman and Pamela Hartsband about their new book, Your Medical Mind. Also, former Jeopardy champ Ken Jennings, his new book, Maphead, is about the world of map nerds. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Just what is President Obama proposing be changed about Medicare to make cuts in the deficit? Also, the Philadelphia choir boy turned rock and roll harpist, now known as Active Child. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about Syria today on the show. While President Bashar al-Assad is still in power, he's been increasingly isolated and condemned for his violent tactics against a civilian population. The Arab Spring that has rippled through much of the Middle East and North Africa is also rippling through Syria. And we are talking with Hazem Halak, a scientist living here in the Philadelphia area. His brother was tortured and killed after being detained by government forces this spring. Mourav Jouajati is a Syrian-born professor, and he teaches at the National Defense University. And again, any questions or comments you might have, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Mourav Jouajati, what options do you think does the president of Syria have or face?
I am of the view that we are beyond the tipping point. There was a lot of time and many opportunities in which Bashar al-Assad could have instituted some significant political reforms, and he would have met the reforms that the protesters were demanding initially. What he did instead was truly put some, or promise, cosmetic reforms instead, reforms that were not persuasive either domestically or internationally, and he has, in parallel, increased the use of force, telling the Syrian people that while he is promising things, in reality, he and his regime will continue to be the boss and will not share power with anyone. So much so that the demands of the street, the demands of the protest movement, have shifted from demanding political reforms to now demanding the collapse of the regime. I believe that no matter what he promises now, will no longer be believed again, neither domestically nor internationally. It is way too late for that. And the relationship between this regime and the majority of Syrians, I believe, is truly irreparable.
So how do you think he will hold on to power like Muammar Gaddafi, or do you think some kind of exit will be organized for him? What do you think the future holds for him?
He has shown absolutely no indication of a willingness to make concessions or to prepare for his departure. I think he has taken the decision along with the rest of this family, because remember, governance in Syria has become a family affair. I believe he has taken the decision that he is going to stick it out till the very, very end and make it as costly as possible for anyone who wants to remove him.
And the end meaning the end of his regime?
Correct.
And just hold on to power, what, using the military?
Using the military, he has now really, he doesn't have the imagination, nor really the options to do anything else. Again, if he is going to institute significant reforms, that in itself is going to be the end of his regime. So he's going to have to continue promising cosmetic reforms while, again, using only the security option in the hope that the greater the cost to the civilian population, the more deterred they will be, and at a given point in time that they will simply stay home. This, of course, is not happening. And the protests now are far more widespread than they had been initially.
And Hazem Halak, you live here in the United States. What do you feel that you can do from this country to help Syrians in Syria?
I think what I'm doing now, it's very important, because I'm actually working with like Senator Casey, for example, whom I like to thank very much. He's been a wonderful and compassionate person, and his assistant, Damon Murphy. Also, I'm working with Amnesty International, and also I would like to thank Neil Salmon and James Lynch and anybody who's been donating in my brother's name to Amnesty and other charity. So that's what I'm doing. You know, when Amnesty International report came out, I was called from every country in the world, Australia, Canada, England, Ireland, Switzerland, except the United States. And the reason I think is because the United States people are not really don't know much about what's that region, and they're afraid of going into another war. You know, they don't understand they could help without going to war. You know, it's like what happened
like,
in Libya.
Like in Iraq, for
and,
instance.
You know, yeah, we're not, it's not going to be like they go into Iraq. You know, they could help without, you know, they could help support political system in Syria, help in arrangement of the exit of the current regime. So there's a lot of things we could do from the United States, but unfortunately, most people here don't know where Syria is or what's going on over there and don't understand people there are dying. One person an hour, it's a lot of death.
And this report that you're referring to came out in August. It's titled Deadly Detention, Deaths in Custody Amid Popular Protest in Syria.
Yes, yes.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have done a number of shows about the Arab Spring, and today we are focusing on Syria. Let me get Tony from Bethlehem to join us. And Tony, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. I just have a comment. I'm surprised that where I work, there's a pretty strong contingent of Syrian Americans. And when I talk to them about what's happening over there, they seem to dismiss the entire thing. They say, you know, it's outside agitators or the media is blowing things out of proportion. And I think I get the sense that they feel like they have to defend their homeland or something. And so I'm really glad that these gentlemen are speaking out now. I'm hoping that the perspective will change.
Well, and I want both of them to respond to your call, Tony, but let me start with you, Hazem Halak.
Yeah,
your thoughts?
Tony, very good question. I was one of these people, Tony. A year ago, I was writing the senators to lift the sanction against Syria. I was one of these people who were drinking the Kool-Aid, the way you say it in here. So, yes, I agree with you. There are people like that. Until what happened to my brother, and then you really, you know, your eyes get, you know, you open up your eyes and you say, what's going on over there? And then you find, you find what's going on and then you understand what's going on. But, yes, some people still believe that. And you know why? Because people want stability, you know, and that's one thing. The other thing people mention about sects. It's like if Assad goes, what's going to happen to the minorities? And I'll tell you one thing. There are only two sects in Syria. There's the President Assad sect and non-President Assad sects. And that's it. When Assad goes, it's going to be one sect like they used to be before million and million of years.
And that's S-E-C-T.
Yes, sects, not sex.
Yes, I understand. Let me give you a chance to respond to that as well, Murhaf Jawadi. Have you had a change of heart about Syria?
You know, I used to be a very, very, I don't want to say a staunch supporter of the Assad regime, this is not the case, but I used to be a defender, generally, of Syria. And I also have had to shift positions from day one in this uprising, when the regime began to use lethal force against unarmed civilians. It was simply too much to take. With regard to those Syrian Americans who dismiss this as exaggerated or as foreign conspiracy and so on, I think there are different categories of people. There are those who call home, and inside Syria, their families dare not speak out on the phone because of their fear of being intercepted by the security services. There are those who are in support of the Assad regime. This is, in particular, as my colleague on this program said, in particular because they are of the minorities and they are in fear of what will happen next, of who will come to power next. And so they prefer to have the known rather than to the unknown, no matter how bloody the known is. But increasingly, Syrians, whether inside of Syria or outside of Syria, are becoming aware of just how bestial things have become in Syria in terms of violence.
Tony, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and you can call as well. That phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. Murhaf, let me go back to you. Syria has oil and supplies oil to Germany, to Italy, France, Holland. Does that give that country a certain advantage when it comes to things like sanctions and embargoes?
Not anymore, because the EU has imposed sanctions on the purchase of Syrian oil. Syria's largest clients, you are right, are European countries, Germany, France, Italy, and so on. And these oil exports to these countries accounts for between 25% to 30% of government revenues. Now that the EU has imposed sanctions that will become November 15th, there is going to be that revenue that will be denied to the Assad regime. And the hope is, as a result of the shortage of funds, the regime will be in a difficult position to be able to pay its security forces and its Shabiha. The Shabiha are death squads. They are thugs, and in many cases criminals that have been let free from prisons and paid in order to scare the population through beatings, through extortion, and generally through violence. So while Syria does export oil, with these sanctions, it is going to seriously bite the Syrian economy.
Let me turn back to you, Hassam, and your brother was from Aleppo, and that's one of the, I guess, bigger cities in Syria. Mm-hmm. What is happening in Aleppo today? Is that where your family lives?
Yes. I mean, it's been quiet in Aleppo, but there are demonstrations. Every Friday, as usual. And the reason it happened on Fridays, you know, some people say it's religious. It's not a religious uprising, but this is the only place you can get together and peacefully without anybody attacking them. And, you know, I know for a fact that some Christian people who go to the mosques on Fridays just so they can participate in a demonstration. So, yeah, there used to be a couple of mosques, and they closed actually one of the mosques in Aleppo because, you know, people were starting going out to demonstration from that mosque. The Shabiha, as Madhav was saying, are very strong in Aleppo. It's basically almost 70% of the population are Shabiha. You know, so they have a very hard time to go out and demonstrate as much as they did in the other cities.
And are you concerned that these peaceful demonstrations might turn more violent?
You know, I'm always peaceful as a person. But, you know, after I looked at the pictures of my brother, you know, and I understand people might, when they see their loved one like that, they might turn into violent. But I hope everybody will stay peaceful.
Let me get Alex from Connecticut to join our conversation. And Alex, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I was in Syria about 3 weeks ago. I was there for a month. And honestly, I was treated with all respect. I've been in various places in the country. I didn't see much of a violence like they make it seem like. I mean, there's a lot of exaggerations on behalf of Al Jazeera and Arabia. One of them, they're saying that Al Shabiha were in Paris attacking protesters. And it seems like a joke to me. I mean, how come the Shabiha got to Paris? And my thing is, we should give the government a chance reform, as a Syrian, as an American. Also, I love freedom, I love democracy, but at the same time, we should give a chance.
Well, Alex, let me get Mohrav Joujati to respond to your call. Mohrav, go ahead.
That's an excellent question. The Ba'ath Party, which is the single party in Syria, has been operating in Syria, again with the political monopoly, for 48 years. That's two generations. President Hafez al-Assad had been, the late President Assad, had been in power from 1970 to the year 2000 when he died, and when his son, Bashar, the current president, succeeded him. This is 11 years ago. Now, if in 41 years they are unable to make reforms, I don't know how much time they would need to make reforms. And furthermore, I am of the view that if they are to make significant reforms, that is, power sharing, that is, an honest-to-God multi-party system, that is, a genuine parliament, that is, a truly independent judiciary, if they were to do this, they are cognizant that they would be out of power. In other words, it is not in their interest to institute real significant reforms. And so instead, what they have been doing again, are to put in place cosmetic reforms in order to buy over society. And society is simply not convinced. Syrian society has had it with family rule for 41 years, in which the president is ruling with his brothers and his cousins and his nephews and so on, thinking that Syria is an Assad family farm, and in which the people of Syria are being treated as cattle. And so as part and parcel of this Arab Spring, you know, the phenomenon in Syria is not only specific to Syria, but is mostly true throughout the Arab world. Well, it is an Arab world that is in an uprising against these sorts of regimes, and Syria is no exception.
And
so
the question of
giving time to reform, it is what reforms have been put in place are too little and certainly too late.
And Hazem Halik, I want to give you just the last word, your final thoughts.
I mean, I'm not a politician, so I don't know about giving any more chances for the Assad family. But I think, I don't understand why he's still in power. You know, they have the money, they have everything they want. Why did you just leave the Syrian people alone instead of killing them? I have no idea why he chose this path of destruction, and killing the Syrian people instead of having reform. So this is beyond me, and I really don't see anything coming out except a new regime.
Well, Hazem Halik, I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. And again, our deep sorrow for what happened to your brother.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hazem Halik, a scientist living here in the Philadelphia area. Morhaf Jouajati, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
He's a Syrian-born professor, and he teaches at the National Defense University. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. There are the archives and email as well. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.